Welcome, Sam Scammell here talking with Sue, Sue Gilby. Sue and I go back a couple of years now, I guess,
a few
more than that. First got together, I think it was in the Earth Communities, trying to set up a community-owned, community-run, end up being a restaurant, supermarket, grocery store. We were really just trying to explore different ways of being and living and working together, so we always saw it as an experiment, but it really came out of discussions through a number of people, and we eventually got to the stage where rather than just talking about it, let's just have a go at it and see what happens. Like all experiments, there's no such thing as a failed experiment.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't predict the outcome, but that's what you're experimenting about. You're just seeing what comes out of it. So.
And Chooks is becoming a co-op as well.
Yes, I saw that. And there's a number of groups there in that as part of that. There's generally a move towards cooperatives as a different way of organising. My background, I guess I've come to it more from the legal side of things, so I started out as a lawyer and did a lot of corporate law type stuff and then worked in big corporations, so I know how they work. Really, it's not a sustainable model. It's going to collapse under its own weight because it's all based on the corporation is actually a separate entity. It's recognised in the law as actually a person. So there's actually a debate about, well, there was an article written, can a corporation have a soul? And it can't. But at law, it's deemed to have the same rights as a person. So a company can sue people, it can enter into contracts, just as if it was a person. And yet, the only reason for being for a corporation now is to make money, to pursue a profit. They're called for-profit corporations. So we were talking earlier about money as a means to an end as opposed to an end in itself. Nowadays they only exist to make as much money as they possibly can. They claim they're making that money for and on behalf of shareholders, but again, shareholders aren't, more often not, the shareholders are actually companies themselves. Certainly individuals can make a lot of money out of it, but again, it's making money for themselves. Mm-hmm. Not for the
very limited amount of individuals that make money, and they make money on the backs of other people.
And it is actually the nature of capitalism that the more money you have, the more money you will make. So capitalism always tends towards a very small minority having most of the money. That's the nature of capitalism. Mm. Whereas the cooperative movement is based on mutuality. Have been called mutuals, so AMP was the Australian Mutual Providence Society, so it was a group of people who got together, and it was life insurance, health insurance. They shared the risks and the rewards, which is the essence of insurance. Everyone put in a little bit, and then whoever had the need, they were paid out or supported based on their need. But it was a mutual where everyone was in it together.
That's really interesting because one of the places that's involved with, loosely with Chooks, but has got some money through co-op venture, was in the Barossa and in terms of using renewable energy and PVs. They've got a system whereby you buy what you can afford and if you can't afford it, you can put in other contributions.
Yeah, well, I was talking to them the other day, so that's Rachel. And yeah, they're going through what's called the co-op incubator, which Chooks are a part of and a few others. That whole community solar is a growing field, so there are any number of community solar projects around the place. What we've been talking about is there are various models, but essentially it's about the community funding the installation of solar, whether on their homes, or their own domestic roofs, or on commercial premises. And by the time the solar panels, the solar system, the solar farm is paid for, it's owned by the community, at which point they essentially get free power. But they form a cooperative to start with, so it might be 10 people in the same street could form a cooperative, and they agree to together fund solar on their roofs, and then they exchange that solar with each other. So if someone's got too much solar, they'll sell it into someone else who's got less. And yes, they'll start off by paying a fair price for the energy. It'll still be cheaper than buying it off the grid. But over time, instead of that profit or profit being taken out by the energy company and going towards shareholders or taken out of the community, that profit goes towards actually paying off the initial cost of installing the solar. And we're now, with prices and costs, you're looking at 3 to 4 year paybacks. So in 3 years' time, all you've done is pay your bill like you normally would, probably save 20-30%. By the end of it, you as a co-op or as a group own a functioning solar farm, at which point you don't need the grid anymore.
Which is a fabulous system.
It is, and it ends up in a virtuous circle. So then, having paid off that lot, you can turn around and do the same with the next street over or the suburb. And it just keeps building on itself.
And is that what they're doing?
With the new, the government changed the legislation a little while back. They've now made it easier to form co-ops, and they've made it easier for those co-ops to go off and raise money. So the money doesn't have to come from the people in the co-op. You can get external people to come in and invest in it. The essence of it is it's all local and community based. So it's if you think of it as the community investing in itself or in themselves. End of the day, we're economic animals. We buy and sell, trade, exchange with each other, and by our activities, our knowledge, our efforts, we create wealth. And that wealth is created by forming a community and interacting with each other. It's very difficult to create wealth on your own. The model we currently have is it's extractive. So that wealth that's created is extracted out by parties external to the community. So the community creates the wealth, but the bank takes it out. Or the landlord who lives in another state takes it out in the form of rent. A supplier to that community, you know, you pay for your petrol. That goes to a multinational company. That money's not retained within the community. Whereas if you look on it as money is just a flow of resources, or money is actually energy, so it's a flow of energy, what you need to do is keep that energy flowing. So money is useful only if it's actually been used for something. As soon as you start hoarding it, sitting on a big pile of money, that's no use to anyone. And then as much as possible, you keep that energy flow, that money, within whatever community you're working in. And you can do, there are groups that actually come into a community, do a study, and say for every dollar spent in that community, X percent or so many cents stays in that community and is then re-spent in the community. Whereas, and the numbers are around 60-70% goes straight out of the community. So for every dollar of wealth created in a community, 60-70% of it just disappears. And I wonder why these communities are going backwards. So it's as simple as I go and buy from my local baker. The money I pay for my loaf of bread, the baker pays the local supplier, whether it's a wheat grower. They pay, if they've got community solar, they'll pay the community solar for the use of electricity to keep the ovens going. They'll pay a local person to serve in the store. That person who gets paid, you know, say 20 cents out of the dollar for my loaf of bread, they then go to the next store and spend that 20 cents on. But as soon as they go outside the community and spend that money elsewhere, or they go down to the, I don't know, the Bunnings or the petrol station, that money they're spending, bang, goes out of the community. And there's no commitment by the non-local businesses to reinvest or keep that money in the community. They're all about, we want to grab as much as we can and take it away for ourselves.
So that's the basic structure of a co-op, that is to keep it local?
Well, the structure of a co-op is to keep it amongst the people who are members of the co-op. So one way to look at it, it's, and we talked about this in Earth Communities, was if everyone, so everyone who's a member of a co-op owns everything, so as a co-op, one member, one vote, the 20 members in the co-op are all equal owners. They own collectively whatever the co-op owns, a solar farm, producer co-op, a farm, whatever. So as long as everyone owns everything, then no one person, no one owns any one thing. So at that point, there's no one person, the majority shareholder, who can just say, well, sorry, this is all mine, I'm taking that away. So whereas in a company with shareholders, I can be one person, but I might own 60% of the shares. Mm. That then gives me the rights over everything. Mm. So in a co-op, no one person has any more or less say than everyone else. One member, doesn't matter how many shares or interests you have, one member, you get one vote.
Yeah.
And then the other issue with the co-ops, people say, well, someone's got to be the boss. How do you run it, manage it? Well, we can actually run things. You don't have to have a boss who controls everything. There are various, sociocracy is one sort of model. There are any number of models where we can actually work together and manage things.
Because we've all got a vested interest in making it work as well.
Yeah, and because we recognise that, as I said before, if we only create wealth or value, indeed meaning, out of doing something with others.
It seems to me to be the way of the future and the way of operating. Do you see that there'd be the problems in people disagreeing on particular approaches?
Everyone will have their opinions, I guess. Some of the things you can do about it is, to give it a word, it's called subsidiarity. So the decisions are made as close as possible to the point where that decision has impact, and it's made by the people who know best what's going on. So the example we used, again with Earth Communities, we were looking to buy a coffee machine. The people who made that decision on which coffee machine to buy and how much to pay for it were those who are actually going to be using the coffee machine. So Craig, who was like the manager of the restaurant, he actually didn't have a say in that because he wasn't a barista. He didn't know how to use it. For that to work, there has to be full disclosure of information, though. So people need to know financial information. And the way we're set up at the moment, information is power, so people hang on to the information and use that to control people. Mm. Whereas in a co-op, and again, everyone's entitled to all the information. Now, some people might say, I don't understand accounting or numbers. That's fine, but at least it's available to them and it needs to be explained to them and they need to spend the time so they understand what's going on. And at that point, people will make good decisions or better decisions.
So is this, in your opinion, a sustainable way of operating for the future?
Well, I think it's more than sustainable. I think it's the only way to go. And recognise that there's not one size fits all. There are all sorts of variations, but it's just that concept of mutual, we're all in it together, no one person owns or controls it. And that's how we lived for thousands of years, and everyone was quite happy.
It's like that class element too, doesn't it?
So, I mean, it goes back to that whole concept of ownership anyway. And we've talked about what we have to unlearn. Mm. Well, we've learnt, been taught, been indoctrinated on this concept about free markets, private property, individual ownership. That's only been around for 200 or 300 years.
The sharing economy has been around for a lot longer before that.
Yeah, we know that. Your First Nations, original peoples, they just didn't have a concept of, how can you own the land?
Yeah.
How can you own the air? And yet, we're now, and I can remember growing up where you just turned on the tap or you went to So when you got a glass of water. Nowadays, you have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So where do we get off saying, this company there's got the right to bottle the water and charge people $2 for it? It's ludicrous. And we all sit around and we happily accept it. We pay our money.
Yeah.
So there's a big movement, History of Stuff. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah.
They've got a movement. They've got a campaign going in California against Nestle. So Nestle have somehow or other got the rights to all the water in a certain catchment area. So they're bottling it, shipping it all around the world, God knows what sort of cost, and making billions of dollars out of it. In the meantime, the people right next to it don't have enough drinking water. And yet somehow they're saying back in the 30s, I think it was, 1930s, some park rangers said, this company, you can come in and take some water. We've just lost.
It's fantasy.
We're talking about sort of hope or what we can do to change it, we can start using the weapons they've used against us, against them. Talked before about corporations having legal rights as people, same legal rights as people. What we're now looking at, and there's a movement to give natural things, in effect, a legal identity. So New Zealand recently, they passed legislation giving the I forget the name of it, but it was a river. They gave it legal rights.
Mm.
It became... So that means if someone goes and pollutes that river, the river can sue, can take action against that polluter and get damages. So you say, well, how can a river appear in court? Well, what they've done, they've set up a group of trustees, take action on behalf of the river.
Mm.
And those trustees are a combination of the local Maori peoples and some government and other people, but that's the way we fight back against them, because the companies all say, oh no, we've got these rights, we can come in, and you know, all these free trade agreements, that just gives the companies a legal right to come in and take everything from the true owners, the natural owners. Well, this time we can fight back.
So is that similar to the Pachamama Alliance, where they granted a Bill of Rights?
Yes, it's the same thing. They're saying this, recognising it as a... So a Bill of Rights is about individual rights, say. It's just saying, well, we're giving you the same rights as if you're a living person.
Mm. Which is a real step forward, isn't it? Because it is acknowledging the connection that we have. We are all connected. We are all equal. We have as much right to live as a tree.
I'm not such a fan of sustainable anymore, but I do prefer the term regenerative. I've just finished reading Call of the Reed Warbler, Charles Massey, where he talks about regenerative farming. So it's not sustainable farming in that, well, we just keep doing the same thing over and over and we'll still get a crop at the end of the year. It's actually about farming in a way that regenerates, restores the life in that area. And it all, what we've done is, with the industrial farming, is we've basically killed off the soil. It starts by recognising, you talked about us being connected, well, ultimately, healthy soil, healthy plant, healthy animal, healthy human. But once, so if the soil's dead and not healthy, it doesn't matter how many plants we eat that have been fertilised to death and herbicided and pesticided to death, that plant has no nutritional value to us. And that's why we're all getting fat, because we're eating all this. There's more food available than ever before, but there's no value in it.
Mm-hmm.
Biggest part about regenerative farming is to understand what nature actually does naturally and sit back and let nature do it. So you're helping nature do it. And he talks about himself. He's 20 years, he talks about a property he's regenerated. It's taken him 20 years. But he actually says he's now a lazy farmer. Because he doesn't have to do it. He just goes around and sort of lets it all happen.
Yeah.
And this is all without pesticides, all without fertilisers, all the rest of it.
And where is this?
His farm's in New South Wales, I think. But in the book he talks about 10 or so more farms who are doing the same thing, and he tells their stories and how they've got to where they are. And there is now a movement.
Yes.
And I think that's what we were talking about before. It's not about protest or saying big bad companies, we've got to knock them over. It's about building a movement from the ground up, and it will develop its own momentum, its own strength, so that by the time they realise what we're doing, it's too late for them. So the Monsantos of the world, rather than trying to, I mean, we should still be trying to stop them, but by the time they realise, if everyone just switches to this style of farming, they don't use the Monsanto product. They don't use the GMO seed. And eventually, at some stage, Monsanto will look around and say, hey, no one's buying our stuff anymore.
Yeah, it's the way to go.
So you look at how we got here, right? So the fertiliser industry is an example. Why have we got a fertiliser industry? It's because at the end of the Second World War, the war ended, but they'd built all these bombs out of, or they had all this explosive material, which is ammonium nitrate. Oh, hell, what are we going to do with that? We've spent all this money making it. Oh, okay, we can go and stick it on the farm. So they only went out and promoted the use of fertilisers on farms as a means of recovering some of their costs. It had nothing to do with whether it was good for the farm or the farmers or anything. And that's when the fertiliser industry started. And the evidence has been there for a long time that all that fertiliser does is kill off everything. You know, it literally burns off, kills all the life in the soil, and so the result is, it's the law of diminishing returns. The more fertiliser you put on, the more you kill the soil that's there, the more you've got to put on to generate, in effect, an artificial or a chemical growth in the plant, and the less nutritional or real value in that plant. And then whether you're vegetarian or not, if you then eat the cow or the sheep eating that plant, gets nothing from it. So we eat the meat and we get nothing from it.
Wow, just a never-ending circle. Goes round and round and gets us nowhere and gets some people rich.
It gets a few people rich, very rich, And it's, Monsanto goes around and sues people because a farmer decides to keep, 5% of his crop as seed to plant the next year. I know you can't do that. Or he can't swap his seed with the farmer next door. No, you can't do that. No, you've got to sell it all, and then you've got to buy more seed next year from Monsanto and the others.
Yeah, because it won't grow.
Yeah.
So there's so many things to unlearn that we absolutely need to get fixed in our heads. But I'm interested in this idea of doing things in a positive way and not a negative way. Protest has always been perceived as anti, as against, and I think it worked. Well, it certainly worked in the Vietnam War. There was a movement against Australia being involved in it, and it worked. Gough Whitlam got in and stopped it. But I don't know that it's worked since. Do you think?
I look on it as don't fight the darkness. So the more you fight, the more you push against it, the more it pushes back at you and you actually give it strength. So it's more that concept of you try and use their force, their strength against them. Also, as soon as you stick your head up and start protesting, you make yourself a target. So immediately, bang, everyone will jump on. The value to me in protesting is just raising awareness. So as long as you're out there and you're telling people, hey, just understand what's going on, and that's where it has to start from awareness. We need to understand what we've talked about. We need to understand where we've come from, how we got here, before we can start going to a new or a better destination. There's a joke they tell about the Irish. A fellow was lost in the fields of the countryside in Ireland, and he asks the farmer, he says, how do I get to Dublin? And the farmer says, oh, if it was up to me, I wouldn't start from here. So, yeah, it's important we know where we're starting from.
Yeah.
And then we can say, okay, yeah, we're actually here, but we need to get over somewhere else. But I think we're actually at that stage where 10, 20 years ago, it didn't matter how loudly you beat your drum or jumped up and down. Most people weren't listening. I think we've now got to the stage where people are listening because they're realising what we've currently got just isn't working, and they are looking for an answer or something to say, how the hell are we going to get out of this? So, yes, when people get up and protest now, people will listen, but it's important that the protest isn't just, bad, evil, knock them down off with their heads. It's got to be, yes, you can say, this is what's going on, understand that. Here's what you can now do about it. Here's somewhere to go. At one point it's scary or you just think there's just so much of it, I can't do anything. But then if you look at it, at the end of the day, you can only influence what you can influence. So even if it's just a simple matter of a conversation, that's enough. If that's all you can do at the time, then do it. If it's a matter of saying, okay, I'll buy my eggs from this store or I'll go to the farmer's market, that's something.
Yes.
And over time, more and more people see that. And a lot of it can come just from examples. So rather than someone talking about what they've done and what they're going to do, they just live a life differently. Mm-hmm. And then the people they're in contact with will see that and see, well, actually, that seems to be working for them. I might try and do something similar. And for each of us, we talk about paths and journeys. We're all on our own path, our own journey. But so just because something works for you, so it doesn't mean it'll work for me. Mm-hmm. I can understand or see, I suppose, more why you're doing it, and then I can think, well, what would work for me? Ultimately, it's about getting control back over our lives, in the sense that too many people complain about something, protest against something, and then say, well, what's the government going to do about it? Or why don't they do something about it? Well, it's not up to someone else to do something about it. If you don't like it, you need to do something about it.
It's almost wasted oxygen, isn't it, saying someone's got to do something about this?
Yeah.
Because it's handing it over to an anonymous someone, and it's never going to happen.
Just by being and just by living a life, big change. Mm. I mean, firstly, that change will be in your own life, but then that has a ripple effect. It impacts on the other people. You said it only has meaning through other people. Mm. We can never do it on our own.
I like the idea too of, in terms of buildings and structures, there's a move now to talk about things like living buildings. Buildings that can breathe, don't have a huge impact on the land that they're on, about the same impact as a tree might have.
Mm.
And notion that it's all connected.
Well, again, it's about, in the Western world, we've created us and some other. So where we live, our environment is seen as something separate, distinct from us, that we then work on or control or manage. In fact, if we just saw it as we're all just part of the same environment, the same world, we just work within that. So it's a bit like work's not something separate from what we do. We really need a concept of work. We're just living.
Yeah, work is something that brings us a return, whatever that return happens to be.
Well, when the first missionaries, white missionaries, colonising Africa, their view of the Africans was they're a bunch of lazy buggers because they saw them lying around all the time. The Africans said, well, hang on, we've done everything we need to do to keep ourselves fed, watered.
Yeah.
And the numbers are it's about 20 hours a week. And the rest of the time we can sit around and do what we like.
Yeah.
So you guys are all mad. You're off working all the time. Well, what's the point of it?
Yeah.
You know, once you've got enough to feed and clothe and shelter stuff, why do you keep carrying on with this stuff?
Yeah.
Fabulous
concept, isn't it?
It is.
And, so, who's well, the again, civilized that, ones?
But again, that's one of those things we have to unlearn.
Mm.
So we, part of this, you go to school, you're told, well, study hard, go to uni, get a good qualification, get a good job, you'll get a good wage. And really what you're doing, what they're saying is, well, you go and sign up for a wage for 40 years, and at the end of it you can retire and then do what you really want to do.
What was that all about?
Yeah. So for me, I did that corporate game for 30 years, then got retrenched, and so I was forced to think about life, where I was going, what I was doing, and yes, I'm now back working, but I'm actually doing work I want to do, so I actually don't see it as work.
Yeah.
Now, yes, I still need to be paid, but, and why do I enjoy what I'm doing, or why do I? It's because it's actually got a purpose, and that's what we've lost sight of. So when you go to a job just to get some money, what's the point of that?
Yeah.
But if you're doing something because there's a purpose, there's a meaning or a value to it, then sure, you might still need to be paid, but you're doing it because of that purpose. And that's what, that's not actually a matter of unlearning, it's a matter of remembering.
Remembering.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. We have lost that memory.
Yeah, we have.
But as children we would have had it.
I think we did. Yeah. Growing up, well, I mean, they talk about life being simpler, but I think it was simpler because we just had it was fairly clear what purpose and meaning was. It's a child, you found that just in playing and being with other people.
Mm.
That's what it was all about.
That's the joy. That's fascinating, Sam.
One other thing I wanted to talk to you about, and I listened to Mickey O'Brien's stories, and he was talking about a few things. When I was born, my parents owned a property station outside Alice Springs. So I was a couple hundred miles out of Alice Springs. As I got a bit older, I was at school down here, but I'd go up for holidays and spend them with my father, and we'd go out. He had a trucking business, so he used to go out to stations and road train, pick up all the cattle or whatever and take them back to Alice. So we used to go out and, might be a two-day drive to get there, and then you'd spend a day and a night there loading. So we're usually camped out in the swag. And I still remember, as a kid, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old, waking up and you're lying on your back in your swag, and you just look up and you just see the stars. And even though I've basically grown up in the city and spent my whole life in the city, and you can't even see the stars in the city anymore, that has stayed with me. So it's that sense of place. And for me, in looking at that, it's it's not quite an out-of-body experience, but it's a sense there's more to the universe than just you. There's a greater spirituality, I suppose it is. But there's something greater than you in the universe. And what's a wonderful feeling is you feel, yes, I have a place here. I belong here. I am. This is
part of this.
I'm part of this. And it's accepting me. Everyone around me, every life around me is part of that.
Yeah.
So, and that's something that when you have your bad days or you're living in a crummy house or whatever, you can still, well, I can still go back to that because I experienced it. You've still got that sense of place and belonging. You actually take that with you wherever you go. And I think that's something we can learn or remind ourselves from.
Yeah, and it's vital, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you read anything of Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot?
Yes, yeah.
I think that's just fascinating.
Yeah.
When he saw that, the emotions that he was that overtook him, our significance but our insignificance in the broader.
Well, was that Apollo 8 was the first where they took the picture of the Earth from space, and I think it was on the. Anyway, it's just become this image, and pretty much everyone who sees it. You have the same feeling.
Yes.
You suddenly realise, wow, this is...
And when he says, everyone that you've ever known, everyone that's ever lived and died, everyone lives their life on that planet, Pale Blue Dot.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And, yeah, at the end of the day, that's what gives life meaning. So a lot of people go around, why are we here? What's the point of it all? Well, that is the point of it all.
That is the point of it all. It's the, you know, we were talking about the enormity of it and the enormity of the universe and the stars when you're looking at it. And then you bring it back to a dot from a...
Yeah
it's it is the answer, isn't it?
I think so.
The juxtaposition between that enormity of looking up at the stars and then just seeing the whole thing as just one part of a whole another universe.
So the First Nations, the original peoples, they never even had to ask the question.
No.
They knew it. They lived it. That was just there.
And it guided them into their actions. Yeah, it was all connected.
So they could genuinely think six generations ahead.
Mm.
We can't.
No. Maybe we can. Or maybe grandchildren can.
Well, that's where I see the hope. I look at our kids, and you were mentioning that the school protest the other day.
The school strike.
When you see those kids at that age talking the way they do, thinking the way they do.
So knowingly.
Yeah. I think what I was like at that age. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't care. I mean, in part, it's a tragedy because we've created these problems that
for them.
The kids are now having to think about it at a young age. But, you know, I really think they will be the answer. Mm. They're not going to be as stupid as us. I wouldn't have thought.
They have to be.
Yeah. Because my 30-year-old son keeps saying to me, thanks, Dad. You give me all this crap I've got to deal with. And said, yeah, it's all right for you. You know, you won't be here for much longer.
Well, that's the way of it, isn't it?
Yeah.